Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. There is no feature interview in this week's edition, just a slightly longer news session with Adam Boileau. Then it's straight on to this week's sponsor interview with Thinxt Canary's Marco Slaviero. He'll be along this week with a radical marketing approach. He will be telling us what canaries can't do. But you know what? It is a very useful thought exercise. He'll also update us on the latest stuff that they're up to, the stuff they're doing in the cloud. They've also got some new VMware virtual canaries as well. So Marco will be joining us to talk about all of that in a little bit. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, first up this week, the Wall Street Journal has reported that the United States is considering charging six Russian officials over the DNC email hacks, which is pretty interesting. We've seen them do similar things against Chinese operators and military officials in the past, but obviously with the political consequences of this one, it's certainly newsworthy, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it definitely is. Obviously, there's been lots of, I think everyone's in the camp of generally accepting that it was, in fact, Russia that's been doing it. But yeah, laying charges, even though it's largely symbolic in terms of, actually arresting people because they're going to stay in Russia and they're not going to get arrested. But yeah, it does send a pretty strong message. And of course, we may see if those charges or those indictments are opened up at some point, we may see some of the actual evidence they're using in the process of laying those charges when that comes around, which is going to be interesting as well. But yeah, as you say, the interaction with this and the political climate, both in terms of Trump, who said that these things are not what's happening, and of course Russia's opinions about having their military hackers charged. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
It certainly will be interesting. And they're saying officials too, not operators. So I'm guessing these indictments, when we see them, they're probably going to go up the food chain a little bit in terms of them being slightly senior officials over there in Russia. And the sad thing for them is no more holidays in Thailand. Boo.
Yeah.
Unless you want to get blackbagged. Mm-hmm. So there's that. Mm-hmm. Now, the Associated Press has done some reporting this week, which unfortunately to my eyes, it really looks like they've just basically rehashed some stuff that SecureWorks dropped October last year, where the attackers behind all of this DNC stuff were using Bitly as a URL shortening service, but they forgot to lock down the account. So people were able to grab essentially the shortened links for all of the target landing pages and figure out who they were targeting. There was some discussion of that last year. Lorenzo wrote it up for Motherboard, did some great work there. But it's all come back into this major story now. And I think what's happened is Associated Press have had a peek at the entire target list, but it's a story that's certainly doing the rounds.
Yeah, it's getting mainstream coverage at the moment, which is good. Because it is having some actual technical evidence to hang this stuff on is it's important for the kind of wider discussion. The AP's been through the list of targets that SecureWorks dug up a while ago, and have actually been in contact with a bunch of the people and dug out some of the actual phishing mails from their mail spools to kind of correlate it and give some extra credibility to the story, which I think is a good piece of extra work. But yeah, I was just based on information that came out last year that fairly firmly shows from the list of targets that it was almost certainly Russia. I mean, in terms of the people that were being targeted in the US, but also in the Ukraine and a bunch of other places that you would expect, hacking people from Pussy Riot or other enemies of the Kremlin at home as well. So yeah,
And if it was a 19-year-old 400-pound hacker, I think we said before they would have had to have started many years ago and be solely interested in attacking people of interest to the Russian Federation. So there is that. Rafael Satter, who's the journalist, he actually also wrote up a Medium post that's pretty interesting because there is one new data point in all of this. I've got to say, I'm a little miffed that they didn't acknowledge the prior work by Lorenzo on this, but they did turn up one interesting little fact, which is, of course, we're dealing with the target list from APT-28 or Fancy Bear. And one thing that's interesting, you remember that story about the makers of that Ukrainian artillery app? CrowdStrike did some research that found that this artillery targeting app had been sort of trojaned likely by Russian intelligence, of course. Some people were saying that that wasn't the case, and it turned into this big to and fro. Well, it looks like now that the email address for that developer showed up in that target list. So we know now that's another data point that suggests that, yes, in fact, this Ukrainian artillery targeting app was ponzoored by the Russians.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting follow-up because I remember when we talked about that story at the time and all of the subsequent kind of back and forth about how CrowdStrike weren't, you know, equipped properly to assess, you know, military impact on artillery and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting to see this kind of follow-up and say, well, actually, yeah, like that guy did get owned by Fancybear at the right time for this to have actually been as originally reported. So yeah, interesting, interesting little tidbit buried in all of this.
Yeah, Jeffrey Carr was someone who was calling bullshit on the CrowdStrike stuff, and I've taken a look again at his posts, his Medium posts on that, and they have not aged well. Something that has aged well, though, as I mentioned earlier, is Lorenzo's October 21, 2016 piece, really, which, you know, basically broke the crux of the story already. Speaking of Ukraine, they are now blaming Russia for Bad Rabbit, the ransomware attack, which was, you know, obviously put out there by the same people behind NotPetya. Not so surprising that they're making this attribution.
No, and of course, it's a fun follow-up to last week because we were, you know, we were speculating about what kind of, you know, crazy madness the world was. And yeah, sure enough, yes, it was the Russians pretending to ransomware themselves so as to cover up some other, you know, phishing campaign or something they were doing at the same time. Like, it's just, the world is mad. Like, it's totally mad.
Yeah, so big week of news for APT 28. Hello to the English-speaking members of GRU who might be tuning in. Hi there.
Hi there. How you doing?
You guys have been busy. I hope you're getting overtime for this stuff. Now, last week, it was either last week or the week before, we spoke about a piece Andy Greenberg had written up for Wired about how the diplomatic efforts on behalf of the United States to get China to stop hacking US intellectual property had been quite successful. Now, CyberScoop is reporting that, you know, Chinese hackers are starting to return to focus on US corporations. I've got to say, I found this a bit of a weak story, mostly because there's nothing in the story about intellectual property theft, which was largely what the agreement was designed to stop. It looks like there is some corporate espionage going on and Chinese operators doing a bit of that, but, you know, still, that doesn't seem to me to be a violation of the agreement. I just sort of think, well, headlines like this are a little bit dangerous to diplomacy, which can be a little bit fragile. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, and I agree. When I read the story, I had the same kind of reaction as you, then that there didn't seem to be any particular solidity to it. And the one of the things we had in the stories last week when we talked about this was that, you know, as you said, it was specifically about intellectual property and that there was no intent, and indeed the reality also matched, that they would stop doing, you know, legitimate espionage, legitimate intel. And they used some examples in the write-up from Andy Greenberg last week, you know, about breaking into companies, you know, specifically for national intelligence purposes being entirely above board per this agreement. And yeah, there's no information here that suggests that, you know, the intrusions that this piece of research was based on, just some work coming out of, I think, PwC's response and threat intelligence people. There's no, you know, data there about the sorts of things that were being targeted. So, yeah, like maybe it's a conclusion drawn hastily without necessarily, you know, knowing what these actors were in fact doing in the organizations that
they're
in.
Well, yeah, and we got the third paragraph here, which says experts say the 2015 truce resulted in a noticeable downturn in economic espionage, but there are signs the agreement may be deteriorating under the Trump administration. I just sort of think, well, no, not really. I mean, if you're going to say that, at least back it up. And they just have failed to do that, which is unfortunate because as a news source, they're pretty good.
Yeah, no, it just does seem, it seems a bit thin, and maybe it's, you know, supporting narrative rather than being based on actual good data.
Now, they also mentioned that this group has been using the so-called DDE technique. This is something that we didn't discuss on the show, really, because you tell me it's old, but it's been going around. Like SensePost did a thing about it. This is like some macro-less office thing. Can you just explain it to me?
Yeah, so no, it's a technique that we've been using for a while, I guess. So yeah, it's fun to see it being picked up by other people. But no, it's basically just a trick by which you embed a data source into, you know, into an Excel document or some other Office documents that refers to an external application, and that can trigger execution of another binary that you can use to then bootstrap your payload without using, you know, macros or any of the other more traditional techniques. It works really well because it's a feature. The downside is you have to click through like five warnings to actually get it to execute. Although there's been some development of embedding it in emails
with Outlook, and it's like zero interaction. I think
there have been some improvements that have made the technique more viable. But even with all of the clicking through, like with a properly crafted lure, you can still make it work. You know, people, you just got to encourage people to click through, which you can do. But yeah, so it's a technique that's, you know, just been resurged in popularity lately, and there's been a few enhancements too. But yeah, overall, it's not a super new technique, but yeah, clearly one that's getting people shells. So, you know, yeah, it's got to work.
Is Microsoft squashing this one? I mean, can they?
Well, I mean, they can add some more warnings to it, perhaps, or they could add some whitelists. But so yeah,
people
like
have to click through six warnings instead of five.
Well, yeah. See, I'm not quite sure what they're going to do. I mean, obviously, they're going to have to squash it because it's getting so much traction at the moment. So they'll have to do something. But yeah, I don't know exactly what they're going to do because it's kind of how it's meant to work. And it's not the only mechanism for doing this kind of data embedding. I mean, there's a bunch of different ways. And yeah, if they fix this one, maybe people will go look at the next couple over.
Yeah. CyberScoop is also reporting that the so-called Hackback bill has seven new co-sponsors, which kind of looks like forward momentum, which kind of makes me nervous.
Well, yeah, it does. We've talked about this bill in the past, which would allow people and organizations to, you know, go and hack people that have hacked them. And we've talked, I guess, a lot about the various ways that they can go wrong. But yeah, this actually picking up momentum is, yeah, a little disturbing. There was one bit that I did spot in this that we hadn't talked about previously. It was apparently if you do actually hack back under this proposed legislation, you'd have to then go and tell the FBI that you did, which, I mean, I guess that could be interesting. I mean, that, you know, provides a useful data set for the FBI about who's got the capability and what they're doing. So maybe that would actually be a positive outcome for all of the other things that are going to go wrong.
I just have a feeling with just people being as YOLO as they are, it could get a little bit messy. I think we saw Keith Alexander, former head of the NSA, making comments this week saying, like, this is how wars start. Please, God, don't pass legislation. So, which I think might be a little bit too much hype in the opposite direction. But still, like, yeah, let's just keep tracking this one. Oh, God, please don't let it pass. Anyway, Motherboard has this great story here. And it's, it's a legit issue. More than 1 million people apparently downloaded a fake WhatsApp clone for Android. 1 million downloads before anybody noticed anything. This is terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty rubbish, eh? And apparently this particular fake app was just serving advertising, so I mean, obviously it could have been worse, but it's just not a good look for Google. And I think in this case, one of the tricks they used was they had a non-space white space character in the publisher name, so it's published by WhatsApp Inc. with a different space character in the gap between app and Inc. than
the
real
one. You mean the Alt-255 in old ANSI terms?
Like that old chestnut, yeah, like the Unicode equivalent of that old thing.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's pretty funny that that's a thing that is still fooling people in the year 2017-18. But Google's just really got to get a handle on how awful their app store is.
Yeah, look, it was funny to see this one pop up this week. I did some family tech support this week. Someone's Facebook Messenger app wasn't working, right? And I'm like, okay, that's weird. You know, force close it, reopen it, still not working, reboot the phone, not working. Okay, nuke and reinstall. Go to reinstall, type in Messenger into Play Store. Holy God, man, you've got a lot of options, you know. And I just couldn't believe that. And while they're not, the icons aren't 100% ripoffs, they're very close. But it'll certainly be enough to fool people. And I'm just thinking, why are these things allowed to sit here in this app store? It's nuts.
Yeah, well, it's the whole point of having, you know, sort of a curated walled garden ecosystem is that you have to do some curation and maybe put up some walls in your garden. Otherwise, what are you doing? You might as well just let anyone load anything, you know?
Yeah. So, anyway, there we go. Oh, a bit of accidental drama on the internet this week, Adam.
Yeah, apparently up at Level 3, one of the big backbone ISPs in the US, someone fat-fingered some routing and, a whole bunch of the US internet went wrong for a little while. So, it's just a good reminder for everybody quite how fragile the IP
it's
network
is. It's a good reminder
be.
For everybody that it's a miracle the internet works at all.
Oh, God, such a miracle, yeah.
Such a miracle. Andy over at Wired has written a piece up about, you know, trying to fool Face ID, like, with rubber masks and all that sort of stuff. Face ID is, you know, we've done so well not to talk about it as little as we have, right? Because everyone's super interested in it. Like, you see people tweeting about how they shaved their beard and now they can't unlock their phone and stuff like that. But it apparently looks like a pretty good biometric, and more so just from the usability point of view, you know, like it's an easy thing to use. You just look at your phone and bang, it unlocks.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Apple has expended a bunch of effort so as not to get embarrassed by Andy Greenberg and Wired on launch day. And obviously everyone else wants to take a, you know, take a piece out of their happy story about how good their biometric is. And yeah, the Wired story actually is quite a fun write-up of the various things that they tried, the different types of masks and all the different things they did that didn't actually work. And yeah, good reading, I guess, for anyone listening who does want to go be the person that figures out how to bypass Face ID and, you know, drop a conference talk or something about it. Good place to start. So you see what didn't work already.
Stefan Esser was on Twitter asking, well, will it work with an eye patch? Will it work if you shave your eyebrows? And I said, gee, I don't know, man. Maybe you should try it and make a video. You know, come on, your eyebrows will grow back. It'll be fine, man. Do it for science. It's funny too, because I actually had a Govey type ask me, do you think, it's always funny when you get these sort of questions, but they asked me, do you think the Face ID will work on a dead person? Like, that's a pretty interesting question, I guess, but there you go. Adam Ars is reporting that bug around on-card RSA key generation is a lot more serious than we first thought. Initially, it was reported that it would take, you know, $20,000 to factor a 2048-bit key. Now some people are claiming that with some GPU acceleration tricks and whatever, they can get that down to about $2,000, which is, you know, that's getting into the quite affordable realm for targeted attackers.
Yeah, no, that's definitely an order of magnitude improvement in the cost is a thing that does kind of change the equation a bit here. There's been a bit of kind of back and forth amongst crypto researchers as to who can come up with a better attack. And it does look like, I think Dan Bernstein and friends proposed an attack that was, you know, kind of 25% faster. And then the original researchers who presented it said, actually, we've got one that's four times faster. And there's been a, you know, that we didn't talk about at the time because, you know, I guess they're trying to downplay it a bit, but it does seem like, you know, maybe it is a lot more feasible than we previously thought. And that's, yeah, for some people, and especially if like in Estonia where you're fielding, you know, 750,000 cards, you know, maybe the calculus does change a bit when it's, you know, a full order of magnitude less expensive to carry out.
Yeah. Terrible Tor bug, which basically if you load up a URL, which is a file URL instead of a HTTP or a HTTPS URL, it just bounces out through the plain old internet. That's a big problem, right? Like, talk about just smashing client anonymity. This is a terrible bug.
Yeah, now this really is just not the sort of thing you want in the Tor browser. The exact specifics of how the bug work aren't immediately public. The bug tracking entry in upstream Mozilla's bug tracker is still private at the moment, so I don't know exactly what the specifics but
I think just with a file URI, it like hands off to the OS or something. You're like, it's something that dumb.
Yeah, no, it does seem like particularly dumb, and seems like the sort of thing that I'm really surprised hasn't shown up before. Like, it, like that's.
Oh, and you can see the feds just going, oh man, I wish we found that one earlier, you know? Because all you'd need to do is load up, you know, a few of those file links into, you know, an Onion service or something, and happy days.
And you're done, yeah. No, what a boneheaded.
I wonder
bug,
if you
man.
Could, like, iframe it or embed with it as well, but I'm not sure if that'd work.
Well, I can't see why it wouldn't. Probably all you got to do is get that URL in front of the browser and have it try and open it, and off you go, right? What a – oh, dear.
Yeah. So they fixed it now, as best we can tell. But, geez, man, like, yeah, you really want to make sure you're careful with that stuff. Like, you know, Tor Browser Bundle is all well and good, but you can see why people like the Grok built, you know, a box which will take every packet from your machine and just Tor it, right?
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for not relying on just the browser implementation on your general purpose OS. And even running something like Tails would be a big step up from just the browser by itself. So, yeah, and obviously standalone box is the kind of gold standard for making this stuff not fall for rubbish bugs like this.
Switching over to this week's cryptocurrency news. Lol. The SEC is warning that celebrity cryptocurrency endorsements may be illegal. I've seen sort of guidance sort of trickling out from the SEC on this stuff, so it's not necessarily brand new. But, you know, it's just this ICO thing is getting so insane that the Security and Exchange Commission is saying, hey, Floyd Mayweather, Paris Hilton, stop promoting ICOs, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, on the other hand, like, if you really, are you really taking your financial advice from a boxer and Paris Hilton? Like, I mean, what are you doing with your life? But yeah, I guess people do, right? Everyone's jumping on board, all aboard the blockchain.
I think the idea here is if they're promoting cryptocurrencies, they need to disclose that they're being paid to do so, right? Like, that's the issue here. But, you know, in the interest of transparency and stuff. So they're sort of treating it like touting, you know, like touting a stock. If you're going to tout a stock, you need to disclose the relationship. And I guess for all intents and purposes these days, an ICO is going to be treated by the SEC like a stock, at least when it comes to touting. So that's interesting. The other bit of cryptocurrency news that I hadn't picked up on. Oh, man. So you found this one. It's actually a really great Twitter thread from Dan Guido of Trail of Bits. Disclosure, Trail of Bits is a sponsor, but they've been pushing into, you know, they're based in New York, and obviously there's a lot of finance going on there. So they've sort of been positioning themselves as like cryptocurrency blockchain experts, right? Because if you're going to have some of these companies wanting to build this stuff, they're going to need to think about security. So they've been moving into that area, which means that Dan pays a bit of attention to what happens with this stuff. But this is going to be big news. Anyway, I'll stop prattling. Basically, someone screwed up and now there's like $150 million worth of Ether missing because of a rookie mistake. It's hilarious and awful all at once.
Yeah, it is. This company, Parity Tech, which make a like a multi-signature wallet library framework thing that people can use to store their money in the Ethereum blockchain, they made some newbie mistake in their kind of library code, and then some other noob that was playing with it, you know, learning how to Ethereum, accidentally caused their wallet to, like, their library component of multi-signature wallets to just kind of like delete itself.
Because initiate it when they deployed it, and then someone called the init wallet function and bye-bye.
Yeah, well, they called the init wallet function, which took ownership over their library code, and then the guy called like the kill function, which causes that piece of that contract to kind of suicide itself off the blockchain. And then net result is that anyone who had used this particular library in their multi-sig wallet, which is very common amongst ICOs, you know, so that they have multi-party control over their funds, yeah, their funds are now stuck in the blockchain and they're not going to get them back.
It's a new innovation. It's a new innovation. It's called no party transactions.
and no transactions either.
Non-transaction transactions. It's the latest thing. But I mean, is the only way back from this is going to be a hard fork, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, to the extent that I understand Ethereum, which is not a whole bunch because it's just mad. But yeah, I believe a hard fork is the only option they got, which... Yeah, good luck with that.
One of the founders of this company, apparently Gavin Wood, has personally lost $90 million in Ether, which is...
Rough day in the cypherpunk future there, buddy.
That's not the only bit of cryptocurrency news we got this week. Motherboard got out the calculator and worked out the energy costs involved in Bitcoin. They've been a little bit cute with the statistics, sort of averaging it out and extrapolating based on what Bitcoin is worth, like how much electricity you can now justifiably throw at it and still make a profit and whatever, to work out the sort of carbon footprint of Bitcoin. And then they've averaged that out across transactions. And, you know, they've come up with a figure saying that each transaction produces the same amount of amount of carbon as a house in the United States for, you know, 10 years or something ridiculous like that. So I think the numbers, they're playing a bit cutesy with the numbers, but at the same time, it is something that we need to think about. The value of a Bitcoin is essentially underpinned by two things, the cost of GPU and the cost of electricity. And I think it's something we need to think about, right? If we're going to push down this path, do we really want to be using so much energy, like the energy equivalent of a small country, to mine imaginary money tokens?
Well, no, it's a very good point, right? And some of this research is based on a visit actually to one of the larger Bitcoin mines in Mongolia, I think it was, where they were paying electricity prices of 4 cents a kilowatt hour. So, a fraction of the cost of what I would pay here in New Zealand, for example, where it's, you know, 20, 30 cents a kilowatt hour. And they were, A, getting subsidized power from the local utility in exchange for a kickback of part of the profits in their Bitcoin mining, and B, all of that 4 cents an hour worth of power was coming from a coal mine, a coal-fired power plant. So they're using coal to mine Bitcoin, which that's a thing that I'm sure people who'd like to be hip and cool with the modern, you know, cryptocurrency economy really don't want to think about. And it's good to kind of bring it home, you know, and try and make this, you know, the environmental aspects of the computation cost of Bitcoin, you know, a thing that is real for people, which, yeah, I don't think it is for a lot.
No. And it's something I just think we need to really think about it, because it's like, hey, crypto utopia, and it won't be that great when the sea levels rise 20 meters, you know? So just maybe something to think about there. Now, in some not so surprising news, it's been 2 years since the OPM hack, and this story says they are continuing to struggle with cybersecurity. And I cannot say that I'm surprised. We all know that dealing with legacy issues is borderline impossible, right? So I'm not so surprised to see this story out there, but I feel it's one we should discuss.
Yeah, so they've been facing some reviews to see how well they've been doing, and yeah,
not sure so enough.
Sure enough, the answer is not so well. As you say, like retrofitting security into an environment that's got loads of legacy tech and loads of legacy hardware and bad processes and handles a whole bunch of sensitive information, that's really difficult and really expensive. And that's the other half of this problem, is that what are you going to do, right, if you take over a network like that, an environment like that, and you're charged with making it good? Like, at best, you're going to get a whole bunch of vendors sharking around, you know, trying to sell you solutions that aren't actually going to do what you need, and you get taken advantage of, and you still end up with a rubbish environment.
But that's why vendors do well. I mean, they got given a budget kick of about 18 mil, and apparently a significant portion of that funding was set aside for IT. So, okay, let's call it 10 mil. What does that get you, right? I mean, you can maybe bolt on some IDS and upgrade your endpoint detection or whatever, but you're not going to be able to re-architect all of your IT for an organization like OPM for that amount of money. Like, you're not even going to come close.
No, and especially when in organizations like that, the root causes tend to be in how does the trust model work? Yeah. Where do the admins work?
What does your network look like? What are your applications built on? Where are they hosted? Like, it's just, you need to basically detonate and start again, you know, when you're dealing with a network that horrible holding sensitive data like that. And $10 million ain't going to do it.
Nope. And, you know, they're just going to continue to fail to make it good until someone actually is willing to, you know, sit down and pony up the cash to do it properly.
Well, I guess the silver lining is they already got owned, right? So
it's like incremental cost of doing it wrong again, pretty low.
It doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter.
Yeah, yo, low.
Pwn to Own has been and gone, and apparently someone chained 11 bugs to own a Galaxy S8. That's a lot of chaining.
It does seem like quite a lot of chaining. Well, I would like to think that it wasn't that necessary, but I mean, maybe it is. Maybe it was a particularly hard Android phone. But yeah, they got some good money. I think those MWR Labs chained together those bugs, got $25,000 worth for popping that. That included persistent compromise of the device, which is pretty cool. We saw a bunch of the other teams also successful against both Android devices and iOS devices. Some of the Chinese teams cleaned up with, you know, kind of, I think Kihoo 360 got $70,000 for compromising a Galaxy.
Man, go take a walk through Android vulnerability credits over the last, you know, year or two, and 90% of the names are Chinese.
Well, yeah, exactly right. And certainly the same with iOS. I mean, at Pwn to Own, this Pwn to Own as well, I think it was Tencent's Keen Lab. They got $250,000 for two attacks against an iPhone 7 and a baseband attack against the Huawei phone. So that's a good diversity of skills there, both against the core OS and against basebands. So yeah,
it's interesting. It's interesting just seeing China really rise as the source of really good vulnerability research, right? Because everyone in the West who's doing it is selling the bugs off to, you know, off to the spooks, right? Yeah. So maybe they'll go quiet eventually when the Chinese government says, "Hang on, we can use these things." Because we've decided we don't want to use rubbish technique anymore.
Don't want to use DDE bugs.
Well, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
I'll look forward to it, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Okay, this week's show is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. That is T-H-I-N-K-S-T, Thinkst. Thinkst Canary is a company that I'm genuinely proud to be associated with. Thinkst is a small company staffed by extremely smart people. One of those people is Marco Slaviero, and he's joining us this week in the sponsor chair. Thinkst is best known for making small hardware honeypots. You just drop them on your network and they'll look like a file server or a router or whatever you want them to be. And they're just a really great way to get high quality signaling on lateral movement through your network. Thinxt also operates a free service called canarytokens.org, which generates tokens that trigger under certain conditions, so you can insert them into documents or URLs or whatever you want, really. Marco joins us this week to talk about a few things. First of all, he's going to do some weird marketing by telling us what canaries won't help you with, and then we're going to talk about some of their new stuff. They've launched their virtual honeypots for VMware, and they've got some new stuff for use with cloud services as well. Here's Marco.
Canary doesn't solve all your problems. And like some vendors will tell you, they'll only speak about the stuff that they can help you with. But I genuinely think that sometimes it's useful to lay out the boundaries of the things we can't help you with, because that's going to tell you where you need to start looking at something else, another product in terms of covering that part of your risk. So Canary can help you with some things, but certainly there's a lot of things that we can't help you with. So one clear example here is like crypto ransomware, right? So WannaCry is running around your network through NSA exploits. That's not going to touch the canary in a way that's going to make the canary alert. Lost media would be another one, right? So the Heathrow's security plans, like clearly canary's not going to help you there. Credential theft phishing, we can't help you with that stuff. Like if some of your users are handing out credentials to sexy looking emails, we're not going to solve that problem. And we're also not going to have help in the case of a company like Deloitte, where again, it looked like username password was taken and all of their stuff got removed.
Yeah, there was not much lateral movement there, was there? It was just like a cred pair and straight to total ownage by the looks of things.
Yeah. So I think that like the key thing there that you highlight is the notion of lateral movement. So we're specifically, we can help you detect risks which involve lateral movement. But if there's no lateral movement, for the most part, we're not going to be the product that's going to help that. I mean, locally, and you guys have covered this in a few episodes in recent times, but in South Africa, we had what we call the master deeds data loss. That was a SQL dump file that someone had left open on an indexable website directory. Like, we're not going to help you detect.
Well, there's no cure for stupid, Marco. There's no cure for doing something completely insane like that. You're not going to stop that with anything, right? That's a human problem.
For sure. Occasionally we get an email from someone saying, my Facebook is getting hacked. Can you help us detect that? We're like, nope, that's not the sort of thing that Canary is going to help you solve. So yeah, these are some of those things. I mean, there's a few others, but I suspect we've hit the key there, which is that without lateral movement, the canary's not going to have an opportunity to pick that up. I mean,
We should probably also point out too that, I mean, it doesn't make lateral movement impossible. It just means that if you're going to do it, you've got to be really careful, right? I mean, if you are really, really good red teamer and you're coming up against stuff like Canary, it is possible that you'll be able to, if you've got a year and you're really patient, you can probably just take paths through the network that legitimate users do. I mean, what Canary seems to be the best at is identifying when someone's kind of gone a little bit rogue and they're trying to access assets that they don't know what these assets are, but they're looking for stuff, right? That's what it's like. So if an attacker is just happy to follow legitimate users through networks and only touch stuff that they're authorized to access, then it's probably not going to trip. But no attacker behaves that way at the moment.
For sure. And so we've got great proof by examples here where, like in a bunch of our customers, when they get the red teamers in, consistently they hit the canaries because the sort of tagline is that they're supposed to look valuable. And when the canary is for example, it's a network share that looks like it holds documents that purport to be network architecture documents. Like if you're a red teamer and you're not touching that document, like you're failing. Like they have to touch that document. And they do, and they get picked up.
Well, and that's the thing, like red teamers don't typically get enough budget to spend a year on a test, right? So, there's not many attackers who are going to have the patience to avoid these sorts of alarms, right? I mean, I'm thinking, you got to be, these days, if you're in a high impact test, right, or a high impact intrusion, you're working for a government, whatever, you really have to be aware these days, don't you, that thing that looks like it's going to help you achieve your aims could actually be a canary.
For sure. As I said, there's a bunch of nice stories that we get out of our customers showing that, you know, when the, certainly when the attackers are under pressure for time, in the case of the red teamers, like they will absolutely hit them. And yeah, so like
how many red teams have you ruined? I'm curious now.
Certainly a few. Certainly there's been some known personalities, like Twitter personalities, would have tripped up on canaries. Let's put it like that.
Now, look, you know, you're best known for the hardware canaries, of course, the little box. You plug it into your network, works as a honeypot. But, you know, it is a very cloudified world. So you've been working on some cloud and virtual canaries and also integrating the canary token stuff as a commercial offering. How's that going?
Right, so we've got canarytokens.org as that free site where you can get our what we call canary tokens. And on our commercial side, we've been offering basically a paid service for canary tokens for a while now. And the main distinction there is it's already tied into your canary console, but it's also there's a few custom tokens that only exist on the commercial side around G Suites. Specifically and some AWS specific tokens. And so that's sort of the canary token side for us on the commercial side. We've got also now, we've got virtual canaries and cloud canaries. And these are separate from the canary token stuff altogether. So virtual canary and cloud canary are the both VMware and AWS equivalents of our hardware device. So the thing that we originally started doing with Canary was that little hardware honeypot. We still sell that. We sell lots of those. But we've also now, we've been running for a while at beta, both in the cloud and on people's own vSphere or ESXi installations. And at this point, those are now also fully commercial. And so we've got people deploying those both inside the organization, so on-premises with virtual, and then at EC2 with the cloud canary.
So what do you do with a virtual canary, right? Because I'm just sort of wondering what you would try to make it look like. Because you're obviously not going to try to make it look like a home, you know, storage area network or anything like that. You've got to make it look like something that belongs there. So what are people actually? How are people actually using the virtual ones? Because I'm curious about that.
Yeah. So the virtual one supports the same features as the hardware one. People would turn their hardware canary, turn it into a Cisco router. You could do the same thing with a virtual canary. But for the most part, people are going to simulate the other services that they would host virtually, and that could be Linux servers, that could be Windows servers, running the same services that you would find on those platforms.
So you might throw it behind the firewall and have it connected, you know, just have an IP, put it on the same network basically behind the firewall and make it look like a, you know, Elasticsearch or something like that?
So we don't have an Elasticsearch skin. So that's a great idea. I'll make a note of that one. But sure. I mean, like you, so we do support, actually we support the ability to have a custom web skin. So if you felt like putting in a few minutes, you could, generate your own Elasticsearch skin. But yeah, like the short of it is once it's running on, your VMware infrastructure, like the kinds of services that you host on VMware. So whether those be internal websites or, file services or the other kinds of things that you would expect to find there, the canary will slot right in just like it would with the hardware device.
And the same, I guess I was more curious about the cloud instance, right? Because in terms of virtual infrastructure on-prem, that's one thing, but you're not going to have, you're not going to set it up to look like a Cisco router on Amazon, right? Like that just isn't going to make sense. So what do you actually put out there as a virtual canary in the cloud, right? What makes sense in those sort of deployments?
So for our customers who have been trialing the cloud canaries at AWS, so for example, one of them wants the canary to look like a MongoDB. So they run Mongo.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they want to know if someone is inside their network or inside one of their VPCs and is looking for Mongo instances.
Yeah, so that's kind of where I was getting at with like put it on the same network but behind the firewall, make it look like Elasticsearch, whatever, right?
Right. Yeah. So in this instance, that's what they do. So they want cloud canaries in every VPC, and then in each VPC where they've got specific services, the canary will then imitate one of those. So one of the things that your canary can do is it can trigger on specific SSH keys. So we've got, for example, customers at EC2 who actually expose their they might expose their virtual canary or their cloud canaries rather to the public internet, but with the idea that we only trigger if specific SSH keys are used with those canaries.
That's a good idea, right? Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah. So now you can figure out either you can have those as effectively canary token SSH keys, or they can be legit SSH keys that you're looking to see if people are using against your infrastructure, at which point you know those keys are burned.
You mentioned also some G Suite functionality. What does that actually look like? Because I'm curious there, because you know you've got the cloud, and then you've got cloud stuff, and then you've got software as a service, right? Salesforce isn't Amazon or Azure. G Suite isn't Amazon or Azure, right? So what is your right. G Suite product actually look like?
So the G Suite here is specifically referring to a token that one of our guys called Max built for us, and the basic idea here is, we've got a canary token, which is a Word document that alerts you when that Word document gets opened. And at the same time, we've taken that idea into G Suites. So we've got a token, G Suite document that'll tell you effectively when a particular G Suite document has been opened by someone within the organization. So the idea is you basically have this document sitting in your Google Drive. And if someone within your organization opens it, you'll get notified that the document was opened. So it's basically parity for Word documents, but inside of G Suites. And the same thing works with the spreadsheets inside G Suites.
Marco Slaviero, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about canaries, what they can and can't do, and also to talk through some of your new stuff.
Thanks very much, Pat.
That was Marco Slaviero there. And yeah, you would think making a virtual honeypot for VMware would be easy, but it turns out not so much. Everything, amazingly, is version specific, so they had to work pretty hard on that. So congratulations on shipping to the people at Thinxt Canary. You can check them out at canary.tools. Big thanks to Thinxt for sponsoring Risky Business. They are actually our biggest triple platinum diamond dipped in gold and rolled in sprinkles weekly show sponsor. We do love them. So yeah, definitely do check them out at canary.tools. But that is it for this week's show. I'll be back next week with some more security news and current affairs. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.